Recording.
And we're holding on page Vav in Bava Kamma, Ois Yud Gimel. Part of this parak deals with the dinim of Bur, the case where a person digs a pit in Rishus Rabim and an animal falls into it, and then there you have the outgrowths of that, the toldos of that, which are various other cases where a person leaves a hazard. Where a person leaves a hazard in Rishus Rabim and something gets out of, an animal gets damaged by it, and therefore you have, and therefore he has to pay. So in that connection, the Gemara brings the following statement. Tana Rabbanan, lo yisakel adam rishusay lo rishus rabim. A person is not allowed to dig up stones or take stones out of his property and throw it into rishus rabim. A person might have, let's say, a field next to the rishus rabim. The field is full of stones and he wants to clear them out so he has a cultivable land for planting. He can't throw them into rishus rabim because that would be making a burr over there. It happened, in fact, that one time a person was doing that. He was throwing rocks from his property into Rishus Rabim. And one chosid came and found him. The Gemara elsewhere mentions that when it says chosid echad, usually it means either Rabbi Yehuda or Rabbi Loi, which is the regular Rabbi Yehuda in Shas, the regular Rabbi Yehuda the Tana in Shas, or Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava. So it was one of them, anyway, met up with him. Amalei. And he says, Reka, you empty person. And he calls him an empty person. That was Bechlal. That was an insult that you often find in the Gemara when they're talking about somebody who's not behaving the way he should. Ibn Yaakov points out, you have the famous statement of Hillel, Da'aloch Sani L'chavrach L'savid, that don't do what you don't like done to yourself. Don't do it to others. That's the whole Torah. So therefore, this guy is violating that. So therefore, in that sense, he can be said to be empty of Torah as a whole, and therefore he calls him Reka, which literally means empty one. Anyway, he tells him, why are you throwing stones from a property that does not belong to you to a property that does belong to you? Ligligolov, this farmer or whatever, laughed at him. What do you mean? It's the other way around. I'm throwing the stones from a property that does belong to me, my field, into the Rishus Rabim, which doesn't belong to me. Eventually this guy was forced to sell his field. One day he's walking in that same Rishus Rabim, and he tripped over those very same stones that earlier he had thrown out from the field. Omar, he says to himself, now I realize it really was appropriate what that chosid said, why you're throwing stones from a rishus that's not yours into one that is, because ultimately that field turned out to be not mine because I wasn't able to keep it, as opposed to the rishus rabim is always mine, in the sense everybody walks in rishus rabim. So he learned his lesson. The number of interesting ideas that Mephoshim talk about, deeper ideas in this story as well. The field that he thinks is his versus the Rishus Rabim, which he thinks is not his, represents Olam Hazeh and Olam Haba. Many people spend their whole lives trying to improve their Olam Hazeh, not caring about what happens with the Olam Haba, and they don't realize, on the contrary, the Olam Hazeh is not really his field, it's not really his property, in the sense, whatever he has in it doesn't come from his own koichas, it comes from what the Eibishter gives him, as opposed to Olam Haba is really what he earns with his own koichas. So therefore, a person often doesn't realize until it's too late that he's been working his whole life on throwing the stones out of what he thought was his rishus, Olam Hazeh, and now he winds up with a rocky Olam Haba.
Another question here. How can Rabbi Yehuda call someone Reka, Meiser, Rabbi Eliezer?
That in that story with Rabbi Eliezer, when he calls the guy Reka, he did it because he saw that the guy was ugly. So fine, he saw that he was ugly superficially. The Rebbe explains it means that he thought that he has no awareness of the Eibishter. He was seeing actually doing something. The other guy didn't do anything in the story. In Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Shimon, the guy didn't do anything wrong. Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Shimon looked at him and judged him badly. Here the guy is actually objectively doing something wrong, throwing rocks into Rishus Rabim and creating a hazard there.
Yeah, but you just quoted Hill and said, don't do somebody else what you don't want to.
Fine, but you still... Okay, but you still have to give a person mussar, and one way to do that is to address it in that way, yeah. There's a few other interesting things in that regard. Ben Yehoyada makes a similar point about Olam Hazeh and Olam Haba, but in a different vein. The idea being, in other words, that in the story over here, the guy ended up losing his field. The nimshal of it is that a person can forfeit his Olam Haba, and then, as the Gemara says elsewhere, like now he every person starts out with a place in Gan Eden and a place in Gehenim, and then if he's deserving, then he doesn't need his place in Gehenim, and it goes to a Rosh who has to get it, and vice versa. If he doesn't get his place in Gan Eden, then it ends up going to a different tzaddik. So in that sense, so to speak, he had to sell his field, like he kind of forfeited his Olam Haba, and now he realizes the truth. There's also a vote on it that it represents the kind of people. Sometimes you have a person that, like Noyach in this week's parasha, you know, a tzaddik in pelts, I'm yisnafshi itzalti. I'm clearing up the stones from my own field, from my own family, making sure that everything is good in my own life and in my own family's life. What do I care about what's going on with the world at large? But you don't realize that the world at large ends up affecting you as well. A couple of blocks later, it's still talking about the dinim of Bur. So the Gemara mentions the point that, let's say, for example, so you have suppose that Reuven dug a Bur at one point. Now, what would you usually use a Bur for? It's to be filled with water, and then you would use a pail to draw water. So now, at some point, at some later point, if Reuven gives the pail to Shimon, then with that he's transferring reshus of the well to him, and now Shimon would be the one responsible to make sure that it's covered after he uses it. So that leads the Gemara, by the way, into a discussion about certain cases where you give somebody something, and with that you're giving him ownership of the thing. So the Gemara ends up talking about a case where you're selling somebody a flock of animals. So the Gemara says one valid method of kinyan with that. So you don't want to do hagbar or meshicha or what have you with every single animal. One way is the Gemara says you give him the mashkukis, which the Gemara says that means that literally mashkukis. It comes from the Shurdish moshach, which means to draw. So it's something that causes the other animals to be drawn after it. The Gemara says two possibilities: either it means a bell, or it means the lead animal in the flock. The same way they have, like, for example, like you think of people who use dog sleds. Let's say they have the lead dog and all the other ones instinctively follow it. The same way with a lot of different kinds of flocks and herds of animals, you have one which is the natural leader and all the other ones follow it. So therefore, so you give that over to the other person, then automatically with that it's considered that you transfer them ownership of the whole flock. So in this connection, the Gemara brings, now, the implication is if that lead animal is going to go the wrong way, then all the other animals are going to follow suit. So the Gemara says, Dorashahu Glila Aleidir of Chista, a certain person from the Golil, from the north of Eretz Yisrael, one time Darshan in front of Rav Chista, Tab Rogiz Raya Al Ona, when the shepherd is angry at the sheep, Ovid Menegida Samyosa. What he does is he blinds the lead animal, and then it goes the wrong way, and all the other animals follow it. The nimshal being that when there's a group of people that the Eidishter is not happy with them, sometimes how does Hashem do it? He brings unqualified leaders to lead them, and they go the wrong way, and they end up causing everybody else to follow them into ruin. So the importance of having good leaders and realizing that if our leaders are no good, then it reflects back on us. It's because we have to be deserving of good leaders, and then the Eidishter provides them to us. Further on, at the end of the perek, the Mishnah talks about like this. Now, the Pasuk mentions in this connection with this din of a bur, it mentions shur or chamur, that an ox or a donkey falls in there. But the fact is, the halacha is that applies to any other animal. The same thing would apply. Any other animal fell in there as well. The only thing is, the Gemara explains that the word shur means tells us that if a person falls in there and gets injured, then the owner of the bird is not hired for that. And if kalim fall in there, then also not. We learn that from shur or chamur. But other than that, it includes all kinds of animals or birds. And similarly, other things as well. In the Masechta, it's talked about a shur causing damage with its horns or what have you. The same thing would apply to other kinds of animals as well. So the Mishnah explains that in all those things, in many different areas of halacha, where the Torah says, where the Torah mentions specific kind of animals, it doesn't mean only those, it means any other kind of animal or bird or life form. We learn it, ultimately, the Gemara says, we learn it from where in the Dibra about Shabbos, where it says in the second rendition of the Dibra in Parshas Vayeshanan, it says v'shorcha v'chamorcha v'chol behemtecha. So it says there all your animals, and we learn from that it means all the other animals are included, and we learn from it by Gzeira Shavah that the same thing applies everywhere else in the Torah. It mentions shor or chamor, unless there's other implications in the pasuk that refers only to them. So that leads in the Gemara into a discussion of that. There's a difference in the wording in that between the Dibra of Shabbos and the first in Parshas Yisro versus Parshas Vayeshanan. So that leads the Gemara into another discussion over here about another difference between the two versions of the Dibras. The Gemara says, Shor of Chanina ben Ogil of Chia Ba'aba. So Rav Chanan bar Ogel asked Rav Chiya bar Abba, with name Ma, b'dibres harishonim le'nevim behem toiv, or b'dibres achronim nevim behem toiv. Why in the first dibres does it not say toiv, and in the second dibres it does? In the first dibres you have in the mitzvah of kibud av ve'em, in the one in Parshas Yisro, kabedes avechem asimecha, l'man yarichon yamecha ala adam asher Hashem ha'kachon oisim loch. In the second dibres it adds more words, l'man yarichon yamecha u'l'man yitav loch. So it adds the words, l'man yitav loch, so that it will be good for you. So it adds the concept of toiv, which you don't have in the first dibris. Why is that? Asked Rav Chanina ben Ogil. Omalei, said Rav Chiya bar Abba answers, ad sha'ata she'elani l'ma nema bahem toiv, never mind, you're asking why it doesn't say good, why it doesn't say toiv in them. First, let's ask a more basic question. She'aleni im nema behem toiv. Ask me if Bechlal it says toiv in them, im lab or if not. She'eni yadei im nema behem toiv im lab, because I don't know whether it actually says toiv in them or not. Now, a lot of Mephoshim wonder, what do you mean? Rav Chiya bar Abba is one of the great Amiroyim. How does he not know a pasuk in the Torah? So there is a Tosfos in Bava Basra that says, based on this Gemara and based on certain other Gemaras, it seems that not always were the Amiroyim so bucky in the Psukim. The Rambam mentions brings in Hilchos Talmud Torah. A person has to start out, the Gemara tells us in Kiddushin, a person has to start out learning Shlish Mikra, Shlish, one third of his time should be spent learning Mikra, and one third Mishnah, and one third Talmud. But the Rambam explains, based on the Gemara, based on the continuation of the Gemara over there, that that's when a person is starting out. Eventually, when a person becomes an expert in Talmud, in the analysis of the Halachas, then he will spend most of his time on Talmud. Once in a while, maybe he'll review the Psukim and the Mishnayos, so he keeps them in his memory and doesn't forget them. So therefore, based on that, it could be Rav Chiya bar Abba. It had been a while since he had occasion to review the Dibris. You know, this is, you know, if he lived nowadays, for example, when we have Chitas, then we wouldn't have that necessarily, but, you know, like this, this was before that time. So that's one possible answer that, in fact, Rav Chiya bar Abba truly did not know whether it said it. With that said, most of the other Mephoshim don't like that explanation. Iyun Yaakov says maybe he's saying it out of humility. And different Mephoshim talk about different possibilities of what he meant exactly. The Pnei Yeshua talks about that one possibility. It doesn't actually say the word toiv after all. It says l'man yitav loch. So therefore, so does that mean? So he's saying, so you're asking whether it says toiv or not, but the fact is it doesn't actually say the word toiv in there. So what exactly are you asking? Another part of the Rif over here, the Riaf on Iyun Yaakov, gives a long explanation, the gist of which is, he's asking about the Dibris HaRishonim and Dibris HaAchronim. Now, he means by that the ones in Yisrael versus the ones in Varshanan. But the question is, do those in fact represent when Hashem said the Dibris? Is it that the first Luchas had recorded on them what it says in Parshas Yisrael, and the second Luchas had recorded on them what it says in Parshas Vaschanan, or maybe not. Maybe both of them were said originally. Like we have Zoch of Ashomer, the Dibur Echad, and we have other such things like that as well. Actually, the Pnei Yeshua mentions that point as well. It's one thing he says. Thing, it's either the Pnei Yeshua or the Ben Yehoyada. I don't remember. One of them says that the part of the vort is also when you have things that are different in one versus the other. Yeah, we can say that Hashem said them both at the same time, and they're recorded one in one place and one in the other. But when you have these words Laman Yitav Loch, they're missing in Parshas Yisrael. So what does that mean? Did Hashem actually say them at the time, and just Hashem chose to record them only in Parshas Vaschanan, or were they not in fact said at the time when the Torah was given on Shavuos, and Hashem said them only later and told Moshe to record them in Parshas Vaschanan? So therefore, the question be, you're asking me why it doesn't say in them Toiv, but the question is it in fact that Hashem did or did not say Toiv at the time? That would really be the question. And there's another interesting explanation. There's a lot of different other explanations. One very interesting one. He's not asking about the actual word toiv, but rather the Bala Turim points out altogether a few other variations between Yisrael and Vaschanan. Altogether, you have 17 more words in the Aseres Hadibros in Vaschanan than you do in Yisrael. 17 is Gematria Toiv. So therefore he's asking him, why doesn't it say Toiv, the extra 17 words? And Rav Chiya bar Abba can truly say, listen, I didn't count the words. I don't actually know how many words there are in one versus the other. Even an Amora is expected to know the words of Chumash. Fine, he's not necessarily expected to know the number of words. In any case, so there's a variety of different explanations what Rav Chiya bar Abba answers. Anyway, he tells him, Kloch it's sort of Tanchum Bachaniloi. Instead, take yourself to and go to the Tanchum Bachaniloi, show your Rogul Eitz Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi. He was regularly learning by Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi. Show your Baki Ba'agada, and Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi is an expert in Agada. So you ask Rabbi Tanchum Bachaniloi, who was a Talmud of Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, he'll be able to explain to you this kind of thing. Marshaw, by the way, Marshaw and some of the other Mephoshim over here talk about the idea. Now, another difference is as well that, First of all, there's no letter tes actually in the entire Dibros of Rishonis. It's not just that you have the word Laman Mitav Loch in the second one and you don't have it in the first one. There's no letter tes Bechlal in all of the first Dibros. But also, actually Marashah says the question is not so much about why it says Tori Bechlal, because we understand that it means that it means Laman Yarichon Yamecha, Laman Mitav Loch means Olam Abba and Olam Azeh, respectively. So the question is just why it wasn't in the first one. Well, that's what we have to know. Rab Chanina ben Ogil went to Rab Tanchum Bachaniloi. Omalei says, "Mimenu lo shamaiti." I actually didn't hear anything on this from Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi. As much as he was an expert in Agadta, I didn't hear an answer to this particular thing from here. But I do know an answer from a different source. Elakach omalei Shmuel ben Nochum, achi imo sherab Acha Bachanina. Shmuel ben Nochum, who was the nephew of Acha Bachanina, told me the following. Another version is that he's the uncle or the grandfather of Achi Barab Chanina. It might be that he had two different Rav Acha Bar Chaninas in his family tree. One who was his uncle, and the other one where he's his uncle or his grandfather. Whatever the case, the reason is Hoyover Sofemli Shtaber. The reason why there's no test b'chlal and there's no word toiv or any inflection of the word toiv in the first Dibris is because they're destined to be broken. So the question is, if you say from the Shabba my hobby, okay, so the first luchos were eventually going to be broken. So why does that mean there shouldn't be a test in there? Amar Ashi, chas v'shalom, poska toiv miYisrael. Because if there had been the word toiv, or even the letter test, which the Gemara is going to go on to say, the letter test represents toiv, so if that was on the first luchos, and then the luchos were broken, then chas v'shalom would mean that toiv, that goodness, would disappear from the Jewish people. So because the fact that there would be a test on there representing toiv, and then it would be broken, mean that would be it. There's no more toiva for the Jewish people, chas v'shalom.
One word was broken.
Yeah, that's what it means. In other words, that you would it would represent that toiv is gone from the Jewish people. And Nafi Yosef discusses over here in some detail, based on Marashah over here, that there's two different kinds of goodness. There's long life in this world, Laman Yarichon Yamecha, and there's Laman Yitav Loch, which really means an Olam Abba. So if it said Toiv in the first Luchos, then it would mean that would also cease. So instead we have, the Arichos Yomim was written. Fine, the Arichos Yomim ceased, because you don't have before by Matan Torah. The Eidish took away the possibility of death from the Jewish people, but then after the Chetei Egel, that returned. So fine, we don't have the Arichos Yomim that we would have had before, but the Laman Yitav Loch, that still has to continue for Olam Haba, so therefore the Eidish didn't want that would also be broken, and that would also representing that would cease as well. The Maharal has an interesting explanation about it. He says the vort is Toiv b'chlal. Whenever you say that something is toiv, means it's exactly fit for purpose. In last week's parasha, over and over, the Eibishter says, Vayaralekim ki toiv, that the each thing he made, he found is exactly suited for its purpose. So therefore, toiv represents, so the real toiv then is a yid who's on the highest level. So now, if it said toiv in the first Dibris, that would imply that the Torah is available only to a yid when he's on the highest levels. And when the luchos are broken, then that would mean that's it. There's no more room for the Torah in the world because the Jewish people aren't on that level of tzaddik and gemurim anymore. So by not having it in there and only having it in the second luchos, with that, the Eibishter should represent that the Torah is available to people on all levels, even if they're not tzaddik and gemurim, even if they worshipped an eagle and did tshuva and whatever, the Torah is still accessible to them. So that's represented by putting it only in the second luchos. So in this connection, the Gemara continues, Amar Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, Haroya Tes b'chaloymi. If a person sees the letter Tes in his dream, Simen Yofaloy, it's a good Simen for him. So the question is, my time, why is that? What's specific about the letter Tes that it represents good? You're going to say because the positive, because the word toiv it starts with a letter tes. The problem is there's lots of other words that have a letter tes in them that means something negative. Ema, the teteitia b'matate hashmed. You have a positive where Hashem says, I will sweep. They're talking about Bavel, after Bavel was conquered, and was conquered by Dariavish and Kurdish and the rest of that gang, then the positive of Yishaya says in Nevuah over 100 years earlier, the Teteti of the Matate Hashmed. Hashem says, I will sweep it with the broom of destruction. The city of Bavel became a ruin, and it's that Adayamazed. They've done archaeological digs there, but it was never resettled after it was destroyed then. So we see that, and there you have a lot of tests in there. So maybe the test that he sees in his dream represents that he's going to be swept up and destroyed. And the answer is Chad Tess Kamran. You're not saying where he sees a whole line of tesses. He sees one letter tess, so that can't represent the KKT of the Matate, which is four tesses. Okay, the Gemara says, Ema Tum Osa B'Shulaha. Fine, you have a Pasuk in Eicha that says her Tuma is on the hems of her garments. So therefore, the letter tess also represents Tuma. Maybe he sees tess in a dream. It means that. The answer is Tess Bez Kamran. Fine, let's say we don't mean that he saw just a letter tess. He saw a tess and a Bez. So that's most of the word, toiv, so therefore that would represent that it's a good simon for him. The problem is still, aim of tovu ba'aretz shareicha. What about though, you have a pasuk also in Eicha, where you have a negative word that begins with a tes and a bez, tovu ba'aretz shareicha, the gates of the Beis HaMikdash sank into the ground at the time of the Churban. So maybe it means that he's seeing a representation of that in his dream. No, so the Gemara says, Ella, no. Never mind that it's only one test, never mind whether it's a test and a bez. The very fact that he saw a test by itself is a good simon. Ella hoyle posach by a kos of the Torah v'tchila, because the very first time that the Torah uses the letter test is for good. Shem b'reishis ad v'yara l'kim asa'er ki asa'er loiksiv test. Where does the very first letter test appear in the Torah? In the word ki toiv. V'yara l'kim asa'er ki toiv. So therefore that represents, there's something intrinsic about the letter test that represents good. So therefore, the fact that he sees a test automatically represents good. You have all kinds of other negative things that begin with a test. That doesn't matter. The fact is, the first time it's used is for good, and that tells us that the letter test is intrinsically a letter that represents good. Because it's the first time. B'chol, we have there's a concept of Tzadik HaKoyin from Lublin learns from this, that a more general concept. Anytime you have the first time that something is mentioned in the Torah, we can derive from that, from the context of that first mention, something about what it really is, what the real meaning of it is. The Maharal also, actually, the Maharal has someplace an explanation about Ashrei. He explains that each, you know, Ashrei is one of several kapitlach in Tillim that begins with the Aleph Beis. The Gemara mentions we say it three times a day, and one reason is because it's written in Aleph Beis order. But so what? There are lots of kapitlach that are in Aleph Beis order. He has an explanation that each posuk in it, the word that begins with, actually represents the centrality of what that letter represents. So that, for example, the Aleph, the intrinsic meaning of Aleph is Ari Mimcha. The intrinsic meaning of Beis is Bechol, and so forth. And in Ashrei, we have the test pasuk begins, Toiv Hashem Lakoil. So that also fits with this idea that the intrinsic meaning of the letter test is Toiv.
But Aleph means teacher, usually.
It can mean teacher, but he doesn't mean the actual translation of the letter. I mean, what is the letter test? What does the word test actually translate to? He means like what the if you want to talk about what does this letter represent, like what's the basic concept in Yiddishkeit in the world that this letter represents, is incorporated in Ashrei.
All the letters, is the Beis always bracha?
So that's the thing. It's not always. I mean, obviously, Beis can have negative meanings as well, and Aleph has positive meanings. But he's saying that in each pasuk in Ashrei, the word that David chose for each pasuk, that pasuk embodies what that letter is really all about. So here we have the same thing. Marsha gives a long and very interesting explanation over here. Now, you notice the Gemara, when the Gemara had brought up two possibilities about negative things that the test might represent, both of them are psukim from Eicha, and in fact, one is from Perek Aleph and one is from Perek Beis. So what's the significance of that? Marsha says, like this, what was the history of how Eicha was written? So the Pasuk tells us, and the Gemara fills in the details, that Yumiya was told by Hashem to write Sefer. Yumiya, the Navi Yumiya, was told by Hashem to write Sefer Eicha. So he dictated it word by word to his Talmud, Baruch Ben Neriah, and Baruch wrote it down. Then Hashem tells him, and then Hashem tells him, and he in turn tells Baruch, I'm in jail right now. The next time that I want you to take that, the next time if there's an opportunity, I want you to take this Megillas Eicha and read it in front of all the noblemen and the king and all the noblemen of Yehuda, and maybe it'll frighten them into doing tshuva when they hear all these horrific things that are going to happen. So what happens? The pasuk describes that Baruch, sure enough, eventually there was a fast. They were fasting for rain or for whatever it was, and Baruch reads the Megillas Eicha in front of all of the noblemen, and yeah, they're all taken aback, and they go and tell Yehoyakim. Unfortunately, Yehoyakim was a rasha. To make a long story short, Yehoyakim was not impressed by it at all, and in fact, he took the Megillah and cut it up and burnt it. So then Hashem tells Yirmiyah, rewrite it again. And this time the pasuk says, "V'oid noisef aleim dvorim rabim kahema." Much more was added, like what there was before. So the Gemara explains the original Megillas Eicha, as Yirmiyah originally wrote it, consisted of what we have as Perek Aleph, Beis, and Dalet. Now Yirmiyah added also what we have as Perek Gimel. We know that Perek Aleph, Beis, and Dalet are where Perek Hay comes from. I'm not sure. The Gemara doesn't mention. Maybe also Yirmiyah wrote it at that time, or maybe it was added by the Anshei Knesset Gedolah. I don't know. Be that as it may, Perek Aleph, Beis, and Dalet each have a one-time Aleph Beis. Each pasuk begins in turn with a letter of the Aleph Beis. Perek Gimel is each one. You have three psukim for each letter of the Aleph Beis. So therefore, Maharsha explains, now, the first two chapters represent, the destruction of the two Bate Mikdash. So now what happens is, what should have been, the test represents Toiv, as the Gemara is saying over here. Instead, it got transformed into negativity, represented that in the first chapter of Eicha, the test pasuk begins with Tumasa. And in the second one, it begins with Tavu. These are the two psukim that the Gemara is quoting over here. So now we're saying, though, Chas v'shalom, you would think that's it, we're goners. No, in the third chapter, and also in the fourth chapter, all of the psukim begin with the word toiv, or toivim. In Perek Dalet, even in the first version of Eicha already, the test pasuk began with the word toivim, representing goodness, after all. And the third perek, which Yirmiyah added afterwards, every single pasuk begins with the word toiv. So therefore, representing that after all is said and done, we have the two korbanos, but we're going to continue to have toiv, and there'll be a third Beis Hamikdash, which will never be destroyed, and Tisha B'Av itself will become a day of sus and v'simcha. So therefore, that's what the Gemara is representing over here. You would have, when Yehoyakim burnt that original version of Megillas Eicha, you might have thought, Chas v'shalom, poska toiv am Yisrael. That's it. There's never going to be toiv among the Jewish people again. Therefore, when Yirmiyah rewrote it at Hashem's command, he added in the third paragraph three psukim, each of which begins with a letter with the word toiv, to represent that ultimately there will be that goodness. But that's why the Gemara over here, when it's going through these possibilities of what the test and the dream mean, it goes through Tumasa B'Sholeha and Tavu Ba'aretz Shareha, and then the Gemara concludes, no, because we have in the third and fourth chapters of Eicha that everything is Toiv, then that itself represents the letter of that itself. And because the letter test is used the first time in the Torah for Toiv, that means that after all is said and done, after all that Tumasa, after all that Tavu, eventually there will be a Toiv, and that Toiv will continue forever. Maharsha also mentions in this connection, you know, we have the pasuk in Tillim, we have in Tfilah L'David that we're in a few days, we're going to be starting to say it again before Shir Shal Yom. David says over there, Asei imi ois l'toiva v'yiru sonai v'yevoshu. So he says the ois l'toiva represents this letter test. So Asei imi ois l'toiva, do for me a letter, ois literally means a letter, for good, meaning, I won't see that, because the Gemara mentions elsewhere that David never had a good dream, but instead, Sonai, my enemies, where the Gemara says over there, they always had good dreams, so let them see the test and realize that the goodness is for me. I say in me, ois v'toiva, v'yiru sonai v'yevoshu. My enemies will see the test, but let them be embarrassed, realizing that doesn't represent goodness for themselves, but rather for me, for David. The Gemara goes on with another example of something that a person sees in a dream involving letters, where it means something. V'omra b'shrav ben Levi, kol ha'roya hesped b'chaloymei. If a person sees hesped in his dream, a hesped, a eulogy, meaning he just sees the word, as the Gemara is going to go on to say, means chosu olav min hashamayim ufta'uhu, means that Hashem had rachmanos on him and redeemed him. In other words, he was in danger from some kind of zera min hashamayim, and Hashem had rachmanos on him and redeemed him. Because the word hesped then represents the word chos pod. Chos as in that Hashem chos had rachmanos on him. Pod, miloshin poda. However, the Gemara says, so this is when he sees the word hesped in writing. The he is similar to the ches in shape, and by sardim also in pronunciation. So therefore, so it can easily be transformed from hesped into chesped, hesped, and therefore meaning representing this idea that Hashem had rachmanis on him and redeemed him. Marshall says, given that, as we know, the Gemara mentions in Brachas that a dream always has some dvorim b'talim, that's why he doesn't see chesped, that's why he sees hesped with a hey instead of a ches. But it means it represents that point.
What's
behind it being a big sub? The sub, he sees it in writing, meaning, in other words, he sees the word hesped in his dream, as opposed to if he sees an actual hesped, if he sees a gathering where people are talking and then eulogizing a person who is nifter, that's not what we're talking about. That's not a simon that they had rachmanos on him in a shemayim. But if he sees the word hesped in his dream, then this is what it represents, yeah. Okay. Now, the Mishnah... The Mishnah had mentioned the point, again, that a lot of the dinim in the Torah, where it mentions shor v'chamur, apply across the board to all animals. One example of it is kilayim. We know the Torah tells us you're not allowed to cross-breed animals, you're not allowed to hitch up an ox and a donkey together to a plow or a wagon or what have you. So again, the Gemara explains that the same kind of thing, so the same thing applies to all kinds of other animals and birds. So the Gemara mentions in this connection, Amar Shmuel, avos v'avos abur kilayim zebezeh. A domestic goose and a wild goose are considered kilayim with one another. What?
But there's two different species.
There's two different species of goose, a domestic one and a wild one, yeah. They're still considered two different species. Well, that's the Gemara asks why. Maskus lo rova bar avchonin. My timer, why is that? Ilema mishum dahai orich kue vahai zuter kue. Is it because one of them has a longer beak and the other one has a shorter beak, and you're going to tell me that distinction is enough to make them two different species? Elameata, by that logic, gamla parsev, gamla taya. Consider, for example, a Persian camel versus an Arabian camel. You look in pictures or whatever, you'll find two major species of camels. Never mind, you have also camel, you have species from the camel family that are native to America. We're not even dealing with those. But even as far as old world camels, you have one that's much larger and has a thicker neck and is shaggier, where they call it, they call it the Bactrian camel. Bactria is basically modern Afghanistan, more or less. And then you have the Arabian camel, and the Arabian camel is its legs and its neck are much thinner. It's much more streamlined, kind of. So the same thing, the high alim kue, the high cotton kue. One of them has a thick neck, the other one has a thin neck. It's interesting that Rashi translates kue as beak when it comes to the birds, but neck when it comes to the camels. Whatever it is, anyway. Hochinami to have a kilayim zebzeh. You're going to tell me that difference in the size of their necks is enough to make them kilayim? No, they're just two different subspecies. And it's interesting that the Gemara doesn't mention, by the way, that the Gamla Parsa, the Bactrian camel, has two humps, and the Arabian one has only one. That would seem to be a bigger difference in the size of the neck, but nevertheless, the Gemara is saying that's not reason enough to make them considered two species. So why, by the birds, should it be just because of the shape of their beak? Ella, Omer Abaya, no, Abaya says there's a more major difference between them. Zeb Beitzav min achutz, v'zeb Beitzav min b'fnim. The one kind has its beitzim, and we don't mean eggs, we mean the male equivalent, we mean the male beitzim on the outside. The other one has them on the inside. Most birds don't have external genitals. They have a little opening, through which their whatever they need for fertilization comes in and out, and also their waste, etc. But you have certain species of birds that do have external genitals, and that one of them, the avazabur, the domestic or the wild goose, as the case may be, one of them has them on the outside. So that's a major difference. It actually says, it's the avazabur. The wild one has them on the outside, or at least they're recognizable. You can see them. You can see them sticking out from on the outside of the bird's body. That's enough to make a major difference, because the Aruch HaShulchan points out that means, in other words, there's a major difference in how they reproduce. That's enough to make them considered two species. Rapapa Amar, hot to una chota beis of a shichla. Here's another difference. When they lay eggs, the one kind only incubates one egg at a time. You have normally, let's say for example with a chicken, you have a bunch of eggs are developing all together inside the chicken. Then every day they inside the hen. Then every day it lays one of them. It takes 21 days from start to finish of the development of the egg. But meanwhile you have other eggs that are inside it that are developing from its ovaries in various stages. Meanwhile, though, you have, with the avazabur, with the wild goose, though, it develops only one at a time. V'har, as opposed to the domestic goose, to own a kamabeya sabashikhla, it develops inside its body several eggs at a time. So again, there's a major difference in how they reproduce, and that's reason enough for them to be considered different species, and therefore that they're colliding with one another. Why this piece is in Ein Yaakov, I'm not sure. Maybe one point is just that we should realize from it the Nifloes HaBoreh, how the Eibishter makes all the different species, each one exactly suited for the type of life it leads. The Avos HaBor needs to have a different reproductive strategy than the domestic one, the Pashtus, because it's out in the wild and then it's more susceptible to predators, so the Eibishter gave it a different way of reproducing so that it'll be able to keep going. Hakonis Perek Shishi. So the Perek starts talking about a case where a person put his animals inside a pen and then the door fell down or something and they went out and damaged. Under what conditions is he chayev and what conditions is he potter? So eventually that leads the Gemara into the following statement. Tanya Omer Abishua, Dalad Dvarim, there are four things. If a person does them, he's potter from human judgment because these are examples of grumma. He's not directly causing a hezek, only indirectly. But he would be chayev in the judgment of Hashem. Hashem is gonna hold him responsible for what he did, for the damage that was caused by what he did. There are even some mafoshim actually who learn that chayev b'din shemayim means if he wants to avoid punishment by Hashem, he's gonna have to pay the other guy. In other words, potz medina adam would mean if the nizik takes him to Beis Din, they can't force him to pay. But he should realize that Hashem has an out for him, and if he wants to not be punished by Hashem, he better pay up the other guy. Well, the Mephoshim to say it means that he's going to have to ask the guy Mechilu or whatever, but not necessarily would he be required to pay. In any case, the Elohim, Rabbi Yeshua says, they're as follows. A perit gedr b'fnei behemes chaveroi, the first one where he breaks down a fence in front of somebody else's animal. And then the animal goes out and then runs away. So then we're saying that's considered only grumma. So the Gemara deals with each of these things. Why is it only grumma? Why is he not directly responsible? And then the Gemara deals in some detail, which is not here in Ein Yaakov, with each one of them, why he would be potter medina adam. Some mafoshim learn actually that we're talking about whether he's chayev for breaking down the fence itself, whether he's chayev for paying for the fence. Others learn that it's the question of, is he responsible for anything the animal does? One thing the Gemara mentions we're talking about over here, where the fence is rickety anyway, and it doesn't really have much value, and it wasn't going to stand much longer anyhow. So therefore, he's not really causing a direct hazard. The second one is a person bends down somebody else's standing grain towards a fire. So there's a fire nearby, and he bends the stalks of grain so that they come closer to the fire, so now the fire is more likely to catch on to them. So again, he's not causing a direct hezek, but it's an indirect thing. The Gemara works that out in detail. Because one, the Gemara talks about that it could be where it wouldn't reach it with a ruach mitzuya, it would reach it only with ruach she'ena mitzuya. It would take an extra strong wind anyway to reach for the fire to reach there. So he made it more likely that an extra strong wind is going to do it, but a normal wind wouldn't have done anything. The Gemara brings another possibility that it means what he did is, let's say, he spread a blanket or something over the crops. Later on in the Perek, the Gemara establishes that if Reuven lights a fire and it spreads from his property to Shimon, then in many cases he's potter for anything of Shimon's that was hidden, tomon, it's called. They want to have a piece of agadta in a day or two about it. It's all about this concept of tomon, where if you have, for example, grain growing in the field, which is covered up, and it gets burnt in a fire, then the one who set the fire is potter. So then the idea would be over here, that there's a fire raging, and Reuven goes and takes a blanket and covers Shimon's crops with it, and then when they get burnt, then they're considered tomon, and now whoever set the fire is potter. So it's not, he didn't directly cause the hezek, but it's an indirect kind of thing. Because it would have burned regardless. All he's doing is he's making that now Shimon is not going to be able to collect on it because of the dinim of Tamil. That's the second one. The third one, v'asoicho edei sheker lahoyed. The third one is when a person hires false witnesses to testify. And the Gemara explains what we mean is in the end that he hires on behalf of somebody else. So Reuven goes over to two people and says, I'm going to pay you money to testify falsely on behalf of Shimon. So Reuven himself is not gaining from it. If he did, he would have to pay. But here we're talking about he did it on behalf of Shimon. So he himself, so Reuven is not chayv b'dinei adam, but he's chayv b'dinei shamayim. And the fourth one is vayedeya edus l'chaveiro ve'enemeid loy, when he knows edus on behalf of somebody else and doesn't say it. The Gemara says we're talking about where he's one aid, and he's one aid. He would never be mechayv mammon, but he could be mechayv the other guy shvua. So therefore, he's chayiv the din of shemayim, because maybe it would have caused the other guy to say, you know what, I can't swear, then fine, I'll pay up. It's only a grumma, and therefore he's potter. The Gemara, again, the Gemara spends like half an amud explaining the details. Why is each of these things considered only grumma? Why are these the only things that potter din anam chayiv din of shemayim? Aren't there others? And the Gemara ends up saying what Rabbi Yeshua means is each of these things, you would have thought there might be a reason that he's potter, even the din of shemayim, and was saying that no, he's still chayiv din of shemayim. So the chiddush is not so much that he's potter din of adam, the chiddush is that he's chayiv din of shemayim. Basically, in other words, the idea is that there are all kinds of things a person might do where he knows the truth that he means to harm the other guy, and he may pretend and act as though he didn't mean anything wrong, but the Eibishter knows the truth. Okay. Further on in the perek, it talks about maybe we'll leave this piece for tomorrow. It's a little long. Okay. Yom Yom Mashiach HaGa'ola of Zion Tishrei. There's the question, the famous question, if a person's neshama came in a Gilgul several times, which guf is going to rise up by Tchias HaMeisim? Now, so the Rebbe explains in a letter, this is one of the letters from before the Nesius, when the Rebbe had time to be marich in these kinds of things. And by the way, I think we've mentioned before in this shiur that, you know, you look at the letters in the first few volumes of the Rebbe's Igros Kodesh from before the Nesius, and you can see he's spending pages and pages analyzing and discussing and everything, and building tremendous towers of things in Torah and in all different areas of Torah. And then, you know, you kind of had to give it all up in order to be our Rebbe. So we got to realize a little bit the enormous Mesiris Nefesh that the Rebbe did in order to assume the Nesius. So the Rebbe explains, listen, when a neshama comes to Gilgul, the whole point is because it has to be mesakin, it has to be fixing up what it didn't do the first time around. Now, every yid has done mitzvahs, every yid is moli mitzvahs kerimin. That means every time this neshama was on earth, it accomplished some things to fix up certain parts of the neshama. Therefore, by tchias hameisim, each guf will come alive with the parts of the neshama that it worked on, that it was mesakin during its lifetime. So you're going to say, in that case, then a guf doesn't have a complete neshama. The answer is, every bechina includes all the bechinas. So even though you're not going to say there's a part, there's this part, and there's that part, and they're disjoint, every part includes aspects of all the other parts, and therefore, in that sense, each person will have a complete neshama. Balabatish, a way of saying it would be like a flame. You light one flame from another. Which candle has the original flame? There's no such thing. So the same thing over here. Then each one has an entire neshama. Continuing on halachas, now that we've started with the Atadevitz Shulchan Aruch. So we started learning last time that a person has to yisgaber kari, a person has to be strong as a lion to wake up even before dawn to serve the Eibishter. Now this is the Atadevitz said that was midah beninis. But now the Alter Rebbe continues. It's more appropriate for any Yoreh Shemayim and for any person that he says, which is based on an expression of Pasuk and Divrei Hayomim, any person that Hashem has touched his heart and he realizes what he really needs to do, he should be getting up by Chatzos in order to do Tikkun Chatzos. And he would be getting up by Chatzos and clogs it a little bit by saying Al Naris Babel and the rest of Tikkun Chatzos, as it says in Sidurim, for the Churban and for the Golos Hashchina. So the piece actually we're going to learn in the Gemara next, actually, which we didn't have time to start today, is actually about a Yid who would show public mourning for the Churban. So here a person doesn't necessarily have to do it in public, but he should be doing it in private for the Churban and for the Golos. And it says in the Pasuk, Kumi Roini Valaila, get up and cry out in the night, L'Roish HaShmuris, at the beginning of the watches, as in fact the Gemara tells us, Hashem himself, Klog Baklogs at that time, and says, as the Gemara quotes in Barachas, Oili Shech Rabdi Es Besi V'chola, woe to me that I destroyed my house, etc. So, as usual, we say toiv ma'af b'kavana, mehar b'sholei b'kavana. Better a person should say a small amount with kavana rather than a lot without kavana. So it's not like a person has to say the whole nusach, but he should at least be saying some of it, and then sit and learn Torah Shabbat Peh until daybreak. So here you have here the Alter Rebbe is saying that everybody should be doing it, and then in Igeres HaTshuva and Tanya also the Alter Rebbe says that really everybody should be doing it at least every Thursday night, he says over there. So Lamaisa we don't really see, Lamaisa we don't see that people are so noyig to do it. One thing is, so the Eish Shel Avraham on Shulchan Aruch points out nowadays if people are going to be up by Chatzos, they may not be able to focus on davening the next day, and therefore that's a reason maybe why people don't do it so widely anymore. Bechlal, I think there is something, you know, back then it used to be common, people would go to sleep when it became dark, and then they could wake up a few hours later for this, whereas nowadays people stay up people stay up long past dark anyhow, and they don't really have the ability then to get up by chatzos and still be able to get up at a decent time for davening tomorrow morning, so that may be a reason why not. In any case, the Alter Rebbe goes on to say that the Zohar talks tremendously and praises about a person who does Tikkun Chatzos. You have actually in the Siddur after Tikkun Chatzos, you have a collection of Maimorei HaZohar, which the Alter Rebbe says a person is supposed to learn after Tikkun Chatzos. In the Siddur Torah, you actually have those sections of the Zohar printed in full in the Tivos Hashem Siddur, in the old fat Tivos Hashem Siddurim. You just have an index of where they're located. Anyway, the Gemara also mentions that Chatzos Laila is an Eis Rotzen. We know that's when Makkos Pachodes took place, for example. The Gemara has the expression also that Kol Oisik BaTorah BaLaila, a person engages in learning Torah at night, Shechina Kenegdo, then the Shechina is opposite him. That pasuk that we just quoted, Kumi Roini BaLaila, wake up, cry out, or call out in the night, the Rosh HaShmuris at the beginning of the watches, Shifchi Chamayim Libich Noichach Pnei Hashem, pour out your heart like water in front of the presence of Hashem, meaning the presence of Hashem, the Shekhinah is right there with you. When is Rosh HaShmuras, it's Chatzos HaLaila. So therefore, that's what we're saying, then that's the appropriate time to be doing this, to be saying Tikkun Chatzos, and then to be sitting and learning. Chutzal Chesed, he brings that next, yeah. Yeah, so we'll learn that next time, that's Hashem, yeah.